Welcome to Things I Wish I Knew, the podcast from Thinking Faith, a work of the Jesuits in Britain. I'm Julia, I'm in my early 30s and I used to live in a Jesuit young adult community. We all live hectic lives and often don't get time to reflect on what's happening both to us and around us. This podcast is meant to help you to take a moment to stop and think about where you are, where you're going, and where your relationship with God fits into it all. Every week I meet a new guest who tells me about something they experienced which changed their life forever. By talking about the things they wish they'd known, we'll explore the idea that God is in all things. And we'll talk about the part that faith plays in navigating life's challenges. Today I'm speaking to Nisha, who's originally from Dublin and now living in London, working for Bishop's Conference. We talked about his experience of moving to England and how he has to take risks to follow his faith. I know this conversation will challenge me to think about the risks I need to take in my faith. So, Nisha, what was it like growing up in Dublin?
Yeah, I mean, it is one of these things where when you grow up somewhere, you don't really have anything to compare to. Very family focused. So I'm the eldest of seven children, six younger siblings, four brothers, two sisters. My mum is from Galway in the west of Ireland. My dad is from London. So Anglo-Irish family. So my parents decided to break all kind of Catholic stereotypes and decide to have seven kids and live opposite a church. So faith and family were kind of central to growing up. I grew up in the center of Dublin, so kind of inner city, could walk to school in about kind of half an hour, 40 minutes. Was quite involved in local sports clubs, did quite a bit of rowing as a teenager. I think I found Dublin a very warm, friendly, welcoming place. And I think there is a real sense of community and support. And I think growing up, when I had kind of ambitions to come over here for university or to get more involved in rowing or to pursue different kind of charitable things, I really felt a kind of a strong sense of support from my parents. So I think partly because I'm the eldest seven, I think my parents were always quite keen that they would support each of us equally and kind of encourage us to develop our individual personalities and then hopefully as much as possible kind of provide the conditions in which we could pursue those things. So they kind of, I think from an early age, it was pretty clear I was kind of more on the academic side of things. I remember, I think in primary school, partly because I was finding some of the stuff a little bit, kind of unchallenging. I would start kind of designing my own homework to do, which was great for the teachers. Not great for, I think other 7 or 8 year olds probably looking at me kind of askance, wondering like, what on earth is this guy doing? But I always had, kind of a strong academic desire to learn from when I was quite young. So my parents were quite keen to kind of encourage that. But then other siblings, my mum was a stay-at-home mum. My dad worked in the bank. So I would see my mum a lot kind of during the day, in the morning after school, then see my dad kind of later in the evening. Mum definitely had the tougher job. I think having seven kids, all of whom had pretty strong, independent personalities, all of whom saw dinner time and the family dinner table as a chance to kind of debate and experiment, kind of perform different comedy experiments and generally just trying to kind of rile each other up in different ways. I think my mum was a little bit of a saint for kind of guiding us through that period.
I'm just imagining like the fights with seven, because I grew up with two older brothers. So I know that it's just less fights, more discussions about politics and religion and all of that. So I can't imagine with seven.
Yeah, it really, and every night was different. I mean, it's a great blessing because you've such a platform in a way to kind of define your personality. And I think when you've got seven people and like nine people at the dinner table, you have like 20, 30 seconds to speak at most. So you get very good. It's almost like PMQs. You kind of have to get really good at using like limited time to kind of ask the right question or say the right thing. So one of my sisters, Robin, who's I think probably one of the funniest people I know, I think really crafted her humor kind of at the dinner table. It was okay. And she's number 5 of 7. So you have one of the younger ones. So sometimes when you're a bit younger, the big family don't always have the same kind of space or time to speak. So I think she kind of found the opportunity to kind of really craft a personality.
So how did your faith fit into all of that?
Yeah, it kind of developed over time. So growing up, we used to go to Mass across the road pretty much every Sunday as a family. So it's kind of family routine. So my parents kind of, set an example in that way. We'd say grace before meals on a Sunday. I'd say as a family, we didn't necessarily have kind of a communal prayer life. I think that was kind of more of an individual thing. But as I kind of got a little bit older, I became more involved in Opus Dei things. So my uncle Dermot is an imamry in Opus Dei. So when I was about 11 or 12, I started going to get Opus Dei clubs in Dublin, which would normally involve kind of, you go there on a Saturday, you play a lot of football, you do different kind of activities. It could be kind of art or woodwork or animation or different things. You go away on hikes, and then maybe in the evening, you kind of pray together in a chapel, and they have a kind of, what they call a circle, where you receive a little bit of formation, usually on different virtues. some, you know, I mean, when you're 12 or 13, it has to be kind of fairly simple, but it might be, you know, how can you be a more loving brother? Yeah. Try not to speak as badly about your sisters or, you know, annoy your parents as much, or that sort of thing. And then as you get older, it becomes a little bit kind of, you know, deeper and more thorough. So that was something which was kind of part of my life at that kind of turn of primary school, secondary school. Then as I became a teenager, yeah, it was a little bit of a journey. So I was still going to Mass on Sundays, but I think as a lot of teenagers do, you kind of develop more of an independent intellectual life. You know, you have your own kind of interests and you start to kind of push against the boundaries of these things. So I do remember kind of 14, 15, having a lot of debates with my parents, especially my dad, around kind of fate and different things. So around issues like evolution or contraception or the Eucharist or, different issues where I wasn't fully satisfied by the church's teaching. And also because I just hadn't had it explained to me. It was kind of just, you know, passed down at school via the religion textbook. And these things never really featured at Mass. So I just, you know, read things online or in books and think, oh, that sounds like a good counter argument. And then I would kind of raise this with my dad, because my dad would be kind of the main in the house, kind of one with the more kind of theological formation. Those were quite important conversations. We'd often disagree, or I think eventually my dad would kind of get a bit fed up spending a Sunday afternoons trying to defend evolution to a 14-year-old, or trying to defend the church's teachings on the Eucharist. But it was, but I think that was an important period for me learning how to ask questions and how to kind of take it seriously. And also if I wasn't satisfied by the answer, kind of what I did about that. So, I'd say from kind of 14, 15, I was kind of intellectually fairly convinced that the church was right on most things. And at least I hadn't encountered a kind of similarly compelling philosophy or worldview at school or like in independent reading or in conversations with people. I hadn't really found anything else that was as compelling. There were still things I wasn't sure about, but I think generally I thought this seems on balance to be the most kind of coherent way of understanding life and of living.
And I was just thinking, I think it's important that if you grow up with faith, that right. you have those times of wrestling with those
yeah.
questions.
Yeah.
And I know, like, I don't think I had it as young as 14. Mm. I think it was slightly older.
Sure.
But I think I did take that time to like work out, why does the church teach that?
Right.
Rather than just saying, this is what the church teaches and therefore it's correct.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
I think it's crucial. And I think a lot of it is because, and I think God wants us to, right? Like providentially he's given us and like gifted us an intellect and he wants us to push against the boundaries of these things, partly so that we can kind of deeper come to know and to love them. You know, that we actually really, you know, in order to, it's a bit like any sort of relationship. You know, if you don't really get to know the person or spend time with them or ask them the hard questions or you really try to kind of do life together, you're going to have a fairly surface level understanding of that person. And I think actually a limited capacity to really love them. So I think that, yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important to kind of test these things. And also, you know, we have hundreds and thousands of years of theology and tradition. And I think that's one thing I found interesting was a lot of the questions I had already been asked by multiple people. Which, you know, takes a little bit of, you lose a little bit of intellectual pride. You know, you realize as a 14-year-old, you're not, you know, you haven't come up with some, you know, kind of novel criticisms of Catholicism. But it was helpful because I could kind of, draw on those. And also gives you confidence that actually, you know, these are saints who are asking these questions. You know, like this is actually, these are important things to do. The journey, so I think then it was kind of intellectual. It became kind of more social. So I think in some senses, kind of once I was kind of relatively confident about things in terms of like the ideas, then it was almost more a question of, okay, but none of my school friends are Catholic. None of the girls I was seeing were Catholic. Like none of my, not much of my social life around me was particularly Catholic. What's the social advantage in being Catholic? And that was really the thing I struggled with as a kind of 15, 16-year-old was, okay, I think this is true, but it feels like a hospital pass. It feels like a burden, you know, that I can't switch off the part of my brain that thinks it's true. But if I do actually decide to live as if it were true, it's not going to be socially very advantageous. And that just felt like a bad trade-off. And that created a bit of kind of teenage angst with God, really. And I remember one particular Sunday, I went over to Mass, I think probably a little bit late. I think I was about 16. And I was kind of wrestling with these things internally. And I remember going over to Mass and kind of standing at the back of the church, I think around kind of the gospel or, maybe beginning of the Eucharist. And I just had a really strong sense internally that I just thought, and I remember it was odd because I was actually praying to God at the time. So it was weird, but I kind of said to God internally, God, I don't think anyone here really believes this. You know, I don't think the priest or congregation, I think this is all performance. I think people are just here. They don't really know what they believe. They're just doing it on a Sunday as a ritual. It all seems fake. And I care a lot about authenticity and integrity as values. You know, I realized that, you know, more so in time. I think at the time, you know, it was more just the kind of an instinctive response. And I remember actually walking out of the church during the Eucharist, and walking across the road home, which takes about 45 seconds. And actually saying to God internally, God, I don't want to be part of this if people don't believe this, or if there isn't that sense of community, or reason that like it's not a community of faith. I don't want to be part of it. Like, that's not fair. I'm not going to sacrifice for this if this is all a performance. But it was weird because I actually think that moment was the beginning of like my personal faith in a really deep way, because it was actually a moment of really intimate prayer with God and me kind of saying to God, God, I do believe this, but I need community. I need a community of faith. I want to be part of a church where this is supported. And it was kind of me really like wrestling and like taking ownership of my faith in a new way. And then in the kind of year after that, I had quite a few experiences of like still wrestling, but kind of increasingly conforming to it.
So how did you lead from that time of wrestling to end up then going to study church history in England?
Yeah, it's a question. Honestly, I think through many kind of intervening moments. So time of wrestling, I was volunteered to help at a thing called the International Eucharistic Congress in Dublin, which is kind of a big kind of national international celebration of the Eucharist. Yeah, which I think now, you know, age 29 with a deeper faith, I think these things are pretty beautiful. I think age 16, this just seemed like an awful way to spend like a week in June. I couldn't think of anything worse. And it also clashed with, I think, the European Championships in football. I think this was like 2012. And I hadn't actually opted to. It was my Opus Dei kind of spiritual director, or kind of, you know, the leader of our group at the time, who thought this would be a good thing for me and some of the guys in the group to do. And because we had volunteered quite late, or because we hadn't properly confirmed, the only jobs left available were the kind of the most like menial ones. So I was on like toilet duty for a week, which basically involved sitting outside a kind of a row of like port-a-loo cabins, making sure they weren't stolen or they weren't. Yeah. I'm not even sure quite what the job was, but it was basically kind of managing that area, like stewarding it. Just, I remember like, I think it was around, maybe half one, two, I was getting a bit bored sitting outside. Okay, I'll go inside and get a cup of tea. Yeah. And maybe have a look around. And I remember I went in and I met two girls there who I've subsequently kind of came to know 2000 in Ireland. And they were maybe, at the time I was kind of 16, 17, they were probably in their mid 20s. And they just had this remarkable joy and peace around them. And they really like took an interest in me or asked me questions, and just incredibly like friendly and loving. And I really hadn't encountered that before, like among kind of peers, or even, you have that in family or, relatives, but having kind of peers who really were just emitting this sense of like peace and joy, and they just had something about them. And I remember just being really struck by it. And I remember got my cup of tea and I walked back out to the kind of port-a-loo cabin area that's kind of, resumed my kind of my vigil. And it was just a bizarre experience. So I remember sitting there thinking, I want whatever they have. Like, whatever they have seems really good. And, these were not the most like impressive people in the, according to different kind of worldly metrics. I think that's what was kind of like almost a sign of contradiction to me. It was like, it's funny, like these people aren't necessarily people I would expect to be the most joyful, based on my kind of worldview, or at the time kind of, a little bit sectarian, these things. But it was like, they have something that I really want. And that was the beginning of a kind of a, oh, that's interesting. There's something about living this life that brings peace and joy that I hadn't really encountered. So yeah, and then I remember my friend Sean went in to get a cup of tea, and he came out 20 minutes later, and he had the exact same experience. And we just had this conversation, like, that's funny. Like, what is it with these people? And we weren't sure whether it was like a cult thing, or they were just a bit delusional, or, but there was something there. And then later that afternoon, a few other guys turned up to help us volunteer these were guys who were involved in Youth 2000, for those who don't know, who are listening, Youth 2000 is kind of, it's based in the UK as well. I think originated in Germany. It was, I think, a post World Youth Day Sydney creation, but it was kind of, it's basically a lay-led form of mission in the church. So it's run by lay people for lay people with the support of kind of priests and bishops. And they have annual and kind of monthly or kind of weekly retreats and prayer groups. And it's very Eucharistic, it's very Marian. And the idea basically is to kind of encourage young people into the heart of the church and really trying to kind of foster young people in their spiritual lives and create a space of community. And it's been, I think, remarkably fruitful in terms of kind of vocations and conversions and really creating kind of almost like a parallel social space, which I think age 16, 17 is super valuable. So then some of these guys popped in, and these guys are maybe like a year older than us. But I think what I found remarkable was like they were really normal. Like they played sports, they had girlfriends, they had they had interesting hobbies, they cared about academics, but they also had faith and they had this kind of joy and peace. And myself and my friend Sean like befriended these guys and we spent the whole week with them. I think we probably did abandon our voluntary positions. We did a very poor job managing the car park. But funnily enough, actually, I remember like halfway through that week chatting to the Opus Dei guy called Luis Sondasala, who's a friend of mine, a fantastic man, who kind of volunteered us for it. And we kind of said to him, we haven't actually been doing our job very much because we've been having so much fun with these guys and we've been going. I remember we said almost, we couldn't believe it. We said, yeah, we actually spent last night going to adoration. Like, we don't quite know why, but it was really beautiful. We really enjoyed it. And he was like, no, that was exactly what I was hoping would happen. Like, don't worry about the job. Like, that was just a way of inviting you guys into the space. And I'm really glad and if you want to go to 2000 in the summer, I'm happy to drive you guys or do whatever I can to support you. So that was a real time of kind of, I think, interior conversion. And I think for me, it kind of answered that question of, is it possible to have friends who are Catholic and have that community of faith and for that to be something kind of really fruitful and flourishing? And is it possible to be normal and Catholic? Because I think for me at the time, that seemed like the trade-off. It was like, okay, I'd be normal and not Catholic and I have this interior sense of lack of integrity, or I'd be Catholic, but I just then have to swallow kind of, okay, my life is going to be a bit weird.
So is it possible to be normal and Catholic?
That's a good question. I would say yes and no. I mean, no in the sense that I don't think any of us are normal. I'm not really sure exactly. Yeah, I think normal is a little bit of a conceit. But I would say yes in terms of it is possible to be Catholic and to have a deep faith and prayer life and to also have other interests and hobbies, and to have a well-ordered life. So, and I think we should actually. I think it's really important as Catholics that we, our faith is at the core and is our first priority. But we are supposed to have, we're supposed to be involved in sports or activities or hobbies or do charity work or, care about our families or have friends, and we're allowed to have non-Catholic friends. I think it should be part of a really comprehensive, holistic life.
And I guess it comes back to what you were saying earlier about being authentic.
Right.
And being authentically ourselves.
Right.
And our faith is probably the core of who we are, but also doesn't just define us as who we are.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think for different people that looks differently. I think for some people, maybe especially when people convert or come to faith for the first time, they do want faith to be kind of really maybe 60, 70% of what they do every day. And I think for some people that's a very, flourishing thing. I think maybe often that kind of settles down after a bit, or as they kind of settle into it. But yeah, I think that's, and I think it's also trying to avoid a sense of it being a competition. And sometimes it is. I mean, sometimes there is if I'm going to Mass on a Sunday morning, I probably can't be in a nightclub at 3 a.m. on a Saturday night. Like, that's probably not ideal. So there are certain trade-offs that you might need to make in your life, and you might think about, are there parts of my life that actually are kind of cutting against my faith? But I think in some ways, like, that's actually a really important process. I think we all go through this. I think this is a lifelong thing in different ways. And I think that's where I find the Ignatian stuff quite helpful around kind of desire and attachment and detachment and kind of holy indifference and having this sense of, how do we care about the things that do really matter and how do we care less about the things that actually in the final analysis don't matter as much? And I think one of the ways we do that is the way we kind of order our time.
So you went from being 17-ish Eucharistic conference.
Right.
But then you went to England to study church history.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Sorry. It's a long winding kind of long-winded story. But so Eucharistic Congress, going over to 2000, suddenly my faith life became part of my social life. Things that I felt a greater sense of that interior peace, kind of just more coherency. It was still kind of playing rugby, doing different things, but had this kind of, felt like my faith was like more authentically part of who I was. So yeah, I can't remember exactly where the idea of applying to go to Oxford came from, but I think I've always had this sense of a desire to, in whatever I do, for that to be, the best possible version of it. And I think there was some sense of, in a very simple kind of teenage way, you get the chance to go to university once. If I'm going to go to university and I'm going to spend these 2 years studying as hard as I can and balancing with everything else, why not try to go to the best possible university I can? I'd always had the idea of going abroad. And I think because I went to school in the center of Dublin, and the major university in Dublin, Trinity College Dublin, is around the corner from my school, my secondary school. I remember saying to my parents when I was 17, the issue I have is that, like, if I went to Trinity, I would basically just be getting off the bus one stop earlier every day. Like, it wouldn't feel very different. It would be too similar. It wouldn't feel like enough of a change. I just had a sense of I want to go to university and go somewhere different, have a different experience and meet new people and kind of grow more. It was a bit tricky because I was obviously dating someone who was living in Ireland. A lot of my friends were in Ireland. So there was a sense of the social cost. But I think at the time that didn't kind of matter as much. And I think I had a sense of that kind of teenage sense of you can kind of do anything. And yeah, it was like, oh, that's fine. I'll manage that. I'll do that from a distance.
Which is also interesting that you said the social costs didn't matter to you so much when actually you said one of the like kind of barriers to your faith younger had been the lack of social element in the Catholic world.
Yeah, right, sure. And it does seem a bit contradictory. And it wasn't that it didn't matter as much, but I think what I had was, I think I had a clearer sense of kind of personal identity. And I think I had, I think one of the tensions when I was younger in terms of faith was, in some ways, almost like not following my desires, because it was actually, I had a lot of desire for faith, I had a lot of desire for kind of prayer or mass and these things and like intellectual desire for it, but feeling like I almost couldn't follow it, because to follow it would be to kind of ostracize myself in the community a little bit. So I kind of, in some ways, just didn't really back myself. You know, I thought, okay, actually, I can't really do this, because it just felt like a zero sum thing. And I felt like if I do that, I'll be isolated and I'll lose these friends and I'll struggle at school. So I'm going to kind of, you know, suppress these things slightly. So I think the difference probably was that it wasn't so much I didn't care about the social, I think that was probably overstated, but it was more that it was kind of, I had a clearer sense of who I was and kind of what I wanted. And also the fact that that was compatible with having kind of a good kind of community life. And I think I had more of like a positive sum view of it. I think the kind of social cost of moving abroad to university, I think it is actually in practice like bigger than I knew as a 17, 18 year old, in terms of like, you don't see your family as often. You miss a lot of birthdays. You miss a lot of kind of like major milestones. Long distance relationships are harder than living in the same country. Like, it's very hard to keep in touch with friends in a meaningful way if you don't know what's going on in their life and vice versa, and you just have less in common. So I think in hindsight, like when you move abroad for university or for school or for work, like there is a gain and a loss.
So what was the moment that you realized that your faith needed to be central in your university experience?
Yeah, beginning of my second year. I think initially I kind of overestimated how big the transition would be, or underestimated. So I think I thought, okay, I'm going to come over here. I'll do my work. It'd be a bit rough. It'd be a bit tough work-wise, because I'm I'm not massively an historian. So it's not naturally the way I think, at least at the time. So I'm going to have to fight pretty hard to kind of make it work. And then I'll come home and see my girlfriend at weekends, or maybe every few weeks. I'll stay in touch with my friends. I might have, you know, I'll do some rowing in Oxford, so I'll have a few friends through that. But yeah, generally I'll be able to kind of live in both places. And then I realized that actually in Oxford, yeah, that's not ideal. Yeah, you need to be there full time, really. And I think I found the first year pretty tricky, because I was actually coming home quite a bit. I was coming home probably two or three times per term, which, and terms are only 8 weeks. So if you're away two or three weekends, it puts you under a lot of academic pressure. And I was still managing it, but it was like, I definitely wasn't doing as well as I could do. And I had a kind of frustration that I feel like I'm not fulfilling my potential here, because I feel like caught between two stools. And then I come home and I'd see friends, or I'd see my girlfriend any at the time. And it would be like, it'd be wonderful to see them, but I wouldn't feel entirely settled there either, because I would feel, well, like, I kind of have this essay I need to do. And I wouldn't really feel settled in either place. So I had a year where that was just tough and I didn't feel massively happy. And I came back And I remember that summer I went to World Youth Day in Krakow. So it was kind of summer of my first year, and just had this real sense of, I don't feel very happy. I don't feel like I have my life doesn't really feel in order, or it's not quite, I felt very drawn all over the place. And I think I'd almost felt like I'd lost that kind of coherency that I had maybe at the end of secondary school, where things are kind of all pulling in the same direction. So I was actually like, how do I try to recover some of this? But then basically beginning my second year, I think I just had a sense of I need community here, because I was still going to mass pretty much every Sunday and I had a bit of a prayer life and I was doing the occasional Opus Dei thing, but it felt like that wasn't really nourishing me. And then thank God, like I went to the chaplaincy, went to the Catholic Society, and almost immediately met some really good people who are still like, you know, some of my best friends to this day. And I think in my third week, the president at the time, a guy called William Maddock, an American guy, he's now back in the US teaching, a wonderful man. And he was doing actually a master's, I think, in church history at the time. And I think he kind of spotted that I was someone who had faith and was kind of in their faith, but was maybe a bit lost or needed something. And he said to me, hey, like, we've got a position opening up on the committee for a secretary. You know, it just involves taking minutes. They can be pretty simple. And also that cooking and cleaning, you know, after the meals on Thursdays. Would you be interested? You know, no one else has really applied. And I took that opportunity, because I remember thinking, yeah, I don't love minute taking, and I hadn't come here with a desire to become secretary, but I had a sense of, actually, if I am secretary and I'm on a committee, I have to be here every week. It gives me a role and a responsibility. It means at the very least I'll make friends with other committee members, and that will give me a bit of a platform. So yeah, so I did that. And then these are kind of year long positions. So it meant that, like, for, you know, at the end of second year, being a third year, I was doing this. And it kind of changed my life. Like, it, certainly in Oxford, it meant that suddenly I was spending a lot of the week in the chaplaincy at these events. And then you kind of snowballs, like, you meet people, they invite you to other things. You realize actually, which is kind of mad in hindsight, I didn't notice. So yeah, suddenly my life became, I think, just like more coherent. And it was almost that kind of was kind of resonating with that experience I had in the end of secondary school, where I kind of just took a bit of a risk on God and thought, okay, God, I'm going to give you some time and space here. I'm going to get involved in the Catholic Society. I'm going to trust that it's a good thing for me to do. A bit like Youth 2000 or Opus Dei stuff when I was younger. And then thankfully just kind of like reap the fruits of it. And then I decided, because the chaplaincy is residential, I decided to move in my third year.
So how did living in the chaplaincy like shape who you are and your identity and your sense of self-being?
Yeah, hugely. I think the chaplaincy, it was wonderful because I used to work there in the library most days, and I would routinely feel like, the least intelligent person in the room, which was great, which I love being. I much rather be, that is, I think, the right place to be. And I just learned, I remember I used to have like, alongside my academic stuff, I used to have like a separate notepad where I would write down things that I'd learned that day from people around me. And I was like, if my friend Josh, who's a really good friend of mine, who's just completed a PhD on Augustine, that I would recommend everyone read when it's published, although it's probably quite long. But I mean, he's one of the most kind of eloquent, charismatic people I know. And I just learned so much from him. And I remember like how, he would use big words I never heard of before, and I'd write them down and look them up and be like, oh, that's a cool word. Another good friend of mine, Catherine, who was very interested in the Dominicans, like she would really kind of share, some of the wisdom that she picked up from them. So I'd make notes of that. And then a friend of mine, Georgia, was kind of very into like youth ministry and the kind of the pastoral side of things. So it was a place of like great learning, which I think I think quite humbling, because I think sometimes maybe one of the dangers is that like if you're kind of a cradle Catholic or you grow up with these things or you have a big conversion in secondary school, I think you can kind of have a sense, not always like fully consciously, that you kind of feel like you kind of know it or you know who you are in your faith. And you don't think that's going to change. And I think in some ways, like moving into chaplaincy was like quite a humbling, but like very exciting period of like, there's so much here about my faith I had no idea about, intellectually, theologically, spiritually. So I remember that first term in particular, Michaelmas term, kind of October to December 2017, were probably some of the happiest weeks of my life, because I was just learning and flourishing, and felt like I was surrounded by people who cared deeply about their faith, but also had so many other interests and hobbies and things going on. So it was, hugely formative in terms of me. I think kind of, just deepening a love for it, really.
So looking back over your life since you were like 16,
right,
you actually had taken quite a few risks. You like had the first risk of moving to Oxford, and then you had the risk of like staying, well, you moved to London.
Sure.
What did you learn about your faith in that time?
I think it's interesting because I think you're right. But I think sometimes at the time, things don't necessarily seem as risky as they might seem in hindsight. In some ways, I'm kind of glad, almost in a way, that maybe that I wasn't as fully aware at the time of like some of the, like, the separation from family or some of these things, because I think otherwise it can paralyze you if you're almost too aware of all the possible kind of pros and cons of these things. I think in some ways, trusting your instinct and kind of keeping things simple and just kind of following your desires is sometimes actually quite helpful and necessary. It is remarkable, I think, how, like throughout different seasons of my life, God has been there in different ways. And even the fact that my spiritual life has had seasons, and that sometimes it's been more intellectual, or it's been more focused on charity, or it's been more focused on my work, or more focused on study or whatever, or family, that like God has been constant, but also that we never fully come to, like we can never fully explore God. Like there's always more we can learn, and there's always, but also more that we can learn about ourselves and that relationship with God, which I think for me was a big turning point at Oxford, was actually realizing there's so much about myself, my relationship with God and about God that I just actually don't know. And kind of being excited to figure that out. So recognizing that like if we had this conversation in 10, 15, 20 years time, there would be different conversations each time probably, because there would be other big kind of moments of like change or things that I've really learned about my faith in the meantime. But what I would say is like, I think the advantage of taking risks and pursuing your desires and doing these kind of scary, difficult things is, I think what it does, I think in my case, like it really helps to kind of refine a sense of your priorities, but also like how much you can actually depend on God. Because I think there were definitely moments when I was in Oxford sitting in my room in college where you feel pretty lonely and you feel pretty isolated. And part of you feels like, what have I done? Like I've left Ireland, I've left these social communities, and I've kind of, you know, dislocated myself voluntarily, you know, in a mad way. And then you really pray. And then you really deepen, I think, like, and you, I think then you can be really intimate with God. Because then it can be like, God, actually, all of these things are really good and valuable, but they are all actually, they're all temporary and transient. And I think people often have this experience with grief, right? That like when people pass away, or, you know, hopes fail, or your different dreams are disappointing. And there's a real sense of actually, what is my life about now? And I think I've had that moment like several times with these risks, that there are moments in the, especially in that transition when things are hard, things are difficult. And you're kind of, you're in that kind of in-between stage where you've left something behind, but you haven't quite reached the destination. And I think then there are a lot of potential inducements towards like despair, or you might try to go back to what you're doing and, you know, that doesn't quite work, or you try to kind of fast forward and push things too much. And actually sometimes like sitting in that waiting, which is a, we're speaking here in the middle of December, is there's a kind of Advent theme there in a way. Actually like being comfortable with discomfort. And I think as Pope Benedict talks about, like, you know, seeking greatness rather than comfort. I think in a kind of magnanimity, it doesn't necessarily mean that we need to have, you know, great kind of accolades in our lives, but more in terms of like, what is the greatest possible thing I can do in my life? And recognizing that actually God is the constant in that, and that relationship with God can persist despite any change. So I think that was something which I really learned, was kind of actually, even if my life changes around tomorrow hugely, and, you know, someone passes away, or I lose my job, or I go through huge transitions, of course, on a human level, it will be very dislocating and upsetting and difficult. And there are, you know, important emotions there that you need to feel. But actually, I can really also deepen my, and trust my, you know, my relationship in God.
Yeah. So you've obviously learned a lot, but is there anything you'd wish you'd known about trust and living out your faith?
Yeah. I mean, praying more. I mean, that's a simple answer, but I think if I could make one change in my life now, it would be to pray more. I think that's the key. I think in any relationship, you need to be talking to the person. You need to be, you can't be in a relationship with someone unless you're actually in conversation with them. And I think that's, I'd say the times of my life when things have gone best is usually, you know, in a broad sense, you're in conversation with God. And I've been struck by that. There have been many times, especially at university, when things are a bit overwhelming work-wise or academically or combination of different things, that I found, prayer was really both kind of like psychologically, like relieving and settling, but also it just reorientates you. And I think it just gives you a new sense of priority. And it is remarkable how like regaining that sense of like almost having kind of like a heavenly horizon. Like one of my friends at university, like Catherine, used to talk about like the value of having like an eschatological horizon. And I think she's absolutely right that like you need to have your eyes set on heaven ultimately. And that's difficult because you know what heaven looks like and feels like very far away, you know, time and space wise. But having that sense of like the end things in mind, I think as much as we can, which I think kind of prayer reorientates you to, is super helpful. Because I think in that light, a lot of things kind of fall away. A lot of things you thought were important don't seem as important anymore.
I know one of the things that's always helped me is the idea of having your eyes on heaven, but your feet on the ground.
Right.
So you're living in reality, but still praying.
Right, which is hard. Yeah, which is hard, right? Very and I think hard. I think it's very difficult not to do one or the other. Yeah.
But what are you grateful for?
A lot. I think family, hugely. And I think increasingly as I get older. I mean, it's one of these things where you just grow up in a family, and as a child, it's all great. As a teenager, it's all awful. And then as an adult, it's kind of, it's more balanced. But that's something that I'm really grateful for, because I feel like I have inherited a lot of positives from my family and very few like negatives in comparison, really. And I think from my mum, just like her remarkable capacity to love and to be generous and to care about others, and that being an instinct and a starting point, a disposition. And also my mum, I think, has a real sense of like, I think I get any sort of risk-taking capacity I have or desire from my mum. My dad is more cautious and conservative, but my mum is, and he's an accountant. So they're not supposed to be as risk-taking. Whereas mum is kind of more of an adventurous personality, and it makes them, I think, a good team. But, and it's helpful to have both kind of influences. But I think for my mum, just a real sense of adventurousness and a sense of making the most of your life. And I think that's fantastic, because now if I speak to my mum about things, she has that kind of impulse, and I find it really encouraging and enabling. And then for my dad, I think, a kind of a pragmatism, a prudence, a kind of feet on the ground aspect, but also like a desire, a love of education and a desire for to do as well as possible kind of educationally and professionally, which I think, and that being an important value to have as a Catholic. And then my siblings, just such a range of personalities and interests and dynamism. And each like very good people in different ways. I think increasingly just realizing actually how blessed I am partly to have avoided like certain family difficulties that can happen, that can have like really difficult impacts on people's lives. Through no choice of my own. We don't choose the situations we grew up in. And then also like, I think loads of kind of added positives and benefits. So yeah, that's something increasing as I get older. It's like, wow, I'm really glad that when I encounter X, Y, and Z in my life, I think about it in this way. And I think one of the reasons I do is because of my parents.
Thanks for listening to Things I Wish I Knew. I know this conversation will stay with me because often I need to remember to trust in God. He's got the bigger plan. How about you? We'd love to hear how Nisha's story resonates with you. And why not also tell us if you're facing an experience you wish you knew how to look at differently? It might just be something we can help with. You can find out more about this and other themes at thinkingfaith.org. Thank you again for listening. I hope you'll join me again next time on Things I Wish I Knew.